Senior Focus. Hello, this is Senior Focus, and I'm Alex Bonham filling in for Anne-Marie Curie. And today I'm interviewing Mark Dixon, who is the Associate Professor at the University of Auckland and an expert on coastal erosion and adaptation. What have I missed, Mark? I bet you have a really long title.
No, that's just about right. Small correction is that I'm now a professor, but I was associate professor at one point.
Oh, congratulations. I am sorry.
No problem. Thank you.
So, Professor Dixon, how does coastal erosion work?
Sure, yeah, it's a natural process. I think most New Zealanders are familiar with it in one sense or another, coming and going from coastlines around the country or your favourite beach of choice. It involves the kind of process in which waves and currents physically erode sand away from the coastline. So it can involve the coastline physically eroding, retreating landward. And the opposite of erosion is accretion, which also happens quite naturally when sand is reworked back onto the beach by waves and tides, and coastlines can also grow, expand out. So that's kind of coastal erosion in a nutshell. And it might seem simple on the surface of it, but there's actually a lot of underlying processes that can drive these patterns of erosion around the country, which are actually quite a puzzle to try and untangle.
Oh, it's interesting that you've mentioned coastal accretion as well, because we don't often think about that bit. But Kaikoura lift? Do you remember?
Sorry?
Do you remember the Kaikoura earthquake? And it seemed to lift the land. Is that right?
Oh, indeed. Yeah. Indeed, yeah. So that happens around New Zealand's coast periodically during earthquakes. Yeah, Kaikoura, the earthquake lifted up the land in some areas, quite a number of metres around the Kaikoura Peninsula itself. It lifted up the land just about a metre. And so you can think of that as like an instantaneous sea level fall, in the sense that the land is lifted up out of the sea. And of course that causes the coastline position to move seaward. So there's a growth in the level of the coast. And that happens in other parts of New Zealand as well, periodically, along the eastern coastline of the North Island, for example, we see that. But we also see, in some parts of the country, subsidence, which is a process where the land level is actually dropping down. So you can imagine in the areas of coastline where the land is subsiding, the local level of sea level rise at that location is amplified by the land level going down. So we have quite a complex pattern of different rates of sea level rise around the country as a result of these tectonic forces that are sort of superimposed on the overall trend of global sea level rise that we see, which is rising the level of the sea right the way around the planet.
Yes, and that is the overlying trend, isn't it? But in the past, there has been subsidence and sea level rise. I remember Dunwich being a big thing in the UK, this sort of village that was just disappearing into the sea. And I was wondering how societies have adapted in the past to these changes.
Yeah, a lot of coasts do have a long history of coastal erosion. That part of the world that you refer to has been eroding for many hundreds or even thousands of years, and it's quite useful from a scientific and perspective, and also for the perspective of people living along the coastlines, to distinguish between two different types of coastal erosion. So sometimes in scientific circles we refer to acute erosion, which is sort of the erosion that you would see during a storm. You get a big storm like Cyclone Gabrielle, for example, last year, that can erode a lot of sand away from the coastline. But the normal process is that if you wait enough time, that sand gets reworked back onto the beach and the beach naturally rebuilds itself. Whereas chronic erosion is when there's sort of a problem in the sediment budget or some underlying condition that's driving a very long-term retreat of the coast. So, for example, that could be a section of the coastline that's got a deficit in the local sediment budget. Not enough sand is being delivered to the coastline from longshore sediment transport processes or rivers or what have you, and that coast will just continue to erode for a very long time frame. And of course, this can be exacerbated by sea level rise driving these chronic trends. And that part of the coast that you allude to in the UK has been eroding for that reason for a long period of time. And we do have parts of our coast around New Zealand that are like that as well. The cliffs of Taranaki, for example, have been eroding for very long periods of time. The gravel cliffs on the coast of Canterbury, for example, have been eroding for very long periods of time. And so it's quite useful to actually discriminate between those two different types of erosion that we see around the coast of the country.
Got you. So climate change and sea level, as you've mentioned that a couple of times, seems to be sort of accelerating change. What is your take on what is happening with New Zealand's coastline and what challenges will lie ahead with climate change and sea level rise?
Yeah, so sea level rise is certainly with us, and we know that the rate of sea level rise is accelerating. So it's clear, for example, that in terms of coastal flooding, that will exacerbate coastal flooding trends in the future. So it's useful also to distinguish between coastal flooding and coastal erosion. Coastal flooding occurs when you get a storm and water level rises and can inundate homes with water. Coastal erosion, of course, is the wearing away of the land. We expect that sea level rise will exacerbate both of those problems, but the work that we've been doing as a part of our national coastal erosion mapping project, funded under the Resilience National Science Challenge over the last 5 years, has really been to get a national scale picture of the erosion and accretion patterns that have happened over the last 80 years around New Zealand. And that interesting map that's available, or your listeners can go and view that at coastalchange.nz by clicking through to the map, and you can see all of the patterns of erosion and accretion around the country. What's noticeable is that while a similar amount of the coastline has eroded and accreted over the last sort of 80 years, approximately a similar amount, there are local hotspots where the rates of change have been really fast. Some areas have been losing kind of football fields of land over human lifespans. So I guess the work we've been engaged in is to try to get a sense of where those hotspots of change are around the country, because they're kind of on the front line of climate change. It's those areas that we'd expect the effects of sea level rise to be experienced most quickly. There are some parts of the country where the effects of sea level rise on coastal erosion rates may be experienced, you know, some more distant point in the future, areas where we have lots of sediment being supplied to the coast, for example.
Oh, gosh, so this is incredibly helpful work to know where we need to focus our efforts, you know, in the short term, and where maybe it's more of a medium long term sort of conversation.
Yes, we hope so, because it's quite a difficult problem, and certainly councils have got a major challenge in front of them, kind of grappling with the sort of size of the problem. So the ability to be able to kind of zoom in and identify areas of more immediate concern, I think, is helpful, but we shouldn't put our heads in the sand. We do expect that over the kind of, as sea level rise continues to ramp up in years and decades to come, more of the coast we will expect to start eroding and begin flooding under those conditions. So we shouldn't take our eye off the ball in terms of those other areas. There's a kind of an important need to start doing planning and adaptation work now so that we don't experience the worst of those effects later on.
A recent article in Newsroom suggested that New Zealand is running out of time to begin its adaptation journey. Would you say that this is true?
In terms of coastal erosion, there are some communities where I think we're running out of time, with properties almost essentially on the beach face, or in some instances they're on the cliff top, and there is sort of an immediate peril to some of those properties. If we've got another cyclone, Gabrielle, for example, and if this time the cyclone were to occur at the peak of the spring tide, we might expect more significant erosive effects associated with a storm like that. So I think there are certainly hot spots around the country where the need to act is pretty urgent. I think for other communities, we should be undertaking planning now. So even if the threat's not right on your doorstep today, it's a mistake not to do the planning work now, because We know that if we can get ahead of the problem, we have the best chance of keeping people out of harm's way in the future. And I think that sort of goes for planning decisions too. Like, we can avoid a lot of problems in the future if we make sensible decisions about where to build along our coastline and where we shouldn't build. And so I think if we can do that sort of work better, we can get a long way ahead of the problem.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I think that there are some issues there, though, aren't there, at sort of local government level. I know that they have done a lot of GIS hazard mapping, and Auckland Council is doing shorelines adaptation plans, that they focus on council assets. But there is this sort of lingering nervousness, I think, about being taken to court for not allowing developments to happen in areas that may be vulnerable. And there's a caution in council about preventing things unless they have backing from central government to do those restrictions. Have you grappled much with the policy and the financial incentives and the legal risks of making these decisions? Was that beyond your scope as a science professor?
Yeah, it probably is somewhat beyond my scope. Sorry, excuse me. Yeah, I guess our focus is on making sure that we get the best available science out there to help make those sorts of decisions. And I think one of the things that is relevant in this context is that, I mean, councils do have instruments available to them already to try and prevent developments in unsafe places, and they do go through hazard planning processes in which they draw zones on maps where they consider the land less suitable for development, and then in some instances those decisions are challenged by developers. And one of the, I think, issues from a scientific standpoint is that what's true in terms of the future of erosion at one location may not be the same as another location that's not too far down the coast. Coastal erosion is quite a local issue, so there's an importance to collect local scale information that can be used to guide that decision making. And I guess one of the things that we're proud of in this program of coastal erosion mapping that we've been conducting covering the last 80 years of coastal change around New Zealand is that we sort of started mapping at the local scale, at the level of sort of individual properties, and then zoomed outward to cover the whole of the country, which means that there's information right down to the level of individual properties that we think should be helpful for councils and consultants and those engaged in making decisions about where development should occur. So, yeah, I guess it's a long way of answering your question. I'm a scientist, and our expertise and interests are in making sure we provide the best available information to help make those sort of decisions. But I think as a scientific community, we have made a lot of progress over the last 5 or 10 years, and councils now have access to coastal erosion data, wave data at quite local scales, data on sea level rise at local scales. So we're getting closer and closer to the mark where they can make improved decisions about where development should occur and where it should be prevented.
Yeah, and I think we're very, very grateful for the science community for doing that work. And I think, as you said, it's available for everybody to be able to access at a site level. So if you were looking to rent a property or buy a property, that information is just there and easy to access online, isn't it, with a bit of Googling. What was the website again?
Coastalchange.nz, and then you can, there's a big green button for people to click through on the map to go and have a look at their favourite spot around the country or where their house might be. And I think you raise an important point because you know, I think there is an individual responsibility as well for people to think carefully about where they're buying assets. Coastal erosion is not an easy problem in the sense that we know that there are lots of factors beyond sea level rise that are likely to drive the future trend of erosion. So, for example, in New Zealand, you referred to earthquakes earlier on, and when we get an earthquake, Sometimes we release lots of sediment onto the coastline, and counterintuitively, those sediments can actually then buffer the coast against erosion in the future. Rivers supply sediments out to the coastline. So we have parts of the coastline where erosion and accretion rates are mainly controlled by patterns of a longshore sediment transport. We have other areas of the coast where patterns may be mainly controlled by the rate of sea level rise. So it's not always easy for an individual to kind of understand the history of coastal change that they see the property that they might be interested in. But if you click on that location and you see that it's been eroding at 2 meters per year for the last 70 or 80 years, you've at least got a general guide that might be a trend that you should see in the future and be kind of wary of that.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. And there's also an Auckland Council geomap service, which anyone can access, and a natural hazard viewer, and you can look at coastal erosion and flooding and tsunami risk and lots of other risks. So it's all there. There isn't much budget to advertise these things, but they are there, and it'd be great if more people knew about them. So moving slightly on a shift, though, with climate change and sea level rise, there is also that piece around mitigating emissions and trying to, you know, reduce, you know, the impact of fossil fuels on the climate and trying to slow down climate change. We've got the second emission reduction plan out for consultation, closing on 25th of August, and one of the pillars is helping communities prepare. And I wonder, do you know what the government is proposing in order to do this?
I don't have any special inside knowledge of where the government's going with this at the moment. I mean, I do agree that it's really important for people to respond to the calls for consultation and putting in submissions and so forth. I think that matters. I think it's pretty clear that the Climate Change Commission have said that we're a little behind where we should be in general terms for adaptation to climate change issues. So I think there's an imperative on the government to make sure that we move in the right direction there, both in terms of mitigation and adaptation. And I guess speaking specifically about sort of coastal erosion issues, I do think it's important that as a country, we do our bit both on mitigation and adaptation. So, we know we're committed to sea level rise as a result of the effects of global warming already, and we can project with reasonable confidence what the trajectory of sea level rise might look like in the near term. But by keeping emissions down, then we will certainly help future generations kind of curb off the worst effects of sea level rise and other climate change impacts. So, all of the initiatives around supporting national government supporting local level emissions reductions, I think, are very important, both at urban and rural levels, transport alternatives and warm, efficient homes, all of that good work, I think, is absolutely necessary. And then I guess the other piece of that is thinking about, well, what does adaptation at the coast look like? Because we know these erosion concerns are only going to amplify in the future.
So what would you like to see from the government to help with adaptation to climate change?
I think it's important that we, this may sound like a banal thing to some people, but I think monitoring is really, really important. Like on some of our coastlines, when we look at the historic data sets, we see that, the coast may have been historically quite stable, and it may be tempting for someone who lives near the coast in that area to think, oh, well, I've got no reason to worry in the future. And yet scientifically, we know that the coast is a sort of inertia in the face of sea level rise, and that at some point in the future that coast will start eroding and we will have problems where we need to look at adaptation options like retreating from the coastline or building engineering structures. And so we kind of need to know when the worm turns on that problem. So, and the only way to do that is to monitor carefully. So I think when us scientists make big efforts to build data sets like the ones that we have here, but they're really valuable, but they're a sort of a starting point rather than an ending point. And so if we can build kind of coherent national monitoring plans that allow us to kind of get ahead of the problem, identifying triggers, identifying signals of future erosion that can then trigger a change in the planning that we do, the adaptation option that we take, I think that's really important. And then the other part of that is actually doing the planning now so that we know what to do when we start to see some of these signals of sea level rise and coastal erosion being executed. So for some communities, that works urgently required. They're right on the front line of coastal erosion already. For some communities, it may be a decade down the track. But if we get ahead of that now by local government being funded to the extent that we can do the work at local scale with communities that are at risk, we can start to build the adaptation plans that are dynamic and which provide a pathway for communities to kind of adapt to the problems that they face.
So what does a dynamic plan look like? How do you make one?
A dynamic plan, I think, takes account of the fact that we will always have scientific information that's uncertain. Any yep. model projection of the future, by definition, is uncertain and will be somehow different to the course that nature chooses to take. So in the face of uncertainty, we need to be willing to be adaptive. So a dynamic adaptive plan means one where we chart out a range of possible, plausible future scenarios that a community might take in responding to events that are, in some sense, uncertain. That might look like, I mean, I think in the country, we've sort of had a bit of a binary perspective on what we might do at the coastline. Either we retreat from the coast, move our houses and our structures away, or we build a big seawall and try and prevent any erosion. Maybe there are other plausible pathways in between those that might buy ourselves a bit of time as we lead toward an ultimate solution of, say, moving away from the coastline or engineering the coastline. So a dynamic plan is about kind of working with communities through all of those different types of options to chart a kind of a sensible kind of course for the future.
Well, it's interesting you should talk about the binary, because the Waitemata West Harbour Shoreline Adaptation Plan is also out for consultation at the moment until the 26th of September. And they are looking at four possible responses. One of them is do nothing, and one of them is managed retreat. Another one is the hold the line, which is the hard infrastructure. But they've also got a sort of a limited intervention option, which I think is more to do with natural infrastructure solutions or planting up, or I'm not quite sure what the other things they have in mind might be. But it's not the seawall. It's something somewhere in between. But it's interesting, you know, like where has done this already and who is doing it well?
Yeah, I think that's a really important consideration. We've got a lot of opportunity in New Zealand to be able to look at the history of engineering interventions in different parts of the world and to try and work out on a... not just what's effective at stopping coastal erosion, but what are the impacts of making interventions at the coastline. And sometimes there are unforeseen effects. So, for example, if I quote a couple of examples, the Japanese coastline has a lot of engineering. A lot of that went in the 1980s when the economy in Japan was sort of going through that stage of its development. But there are a lot of scientific articles being written by Japanese researchers now commenting, for example, on the removal of or the loss of beaches since the 2000s. So it can be, for example, if you engineer a coastline that you cut off a sediment supply. If we were to engineer all of the cliffs of Auckland, for argument's sake, and stop the houses at the cliff top falling into the sea, that would be good for the property owners who own those properties at the cliff top, But we would also cut off a natural source of sediment for beaches around the Auckland region as well, because the cliffs are made in part at least of sandstone, and that when those rocks break down, they contribute sand that then gets deposited on beaches. And that experience has been well documented on the eastern coastline of the UK, for example, where a lot of the cliffs were defended for many decades. By stopping the cliffs eroding, you stopped sediment coming out of the cliffs, which meant a lot of the beaches started getting smaller. And actually on some low-lying parts of coastline, which were naturally defended by dunes, those dunes started to become smaller and lower. And actually this effect of defending the cliffs from eroding actually compounded the risk of flooding of the low-lying communities. So I guess what I'm getting at there is there are tricky trade-offs, you know, in these decisions. And I think we most certainly should learn the lessons of kind of engineering interventions in different parts of the world. There's no doubt that we will need to engineer portions of our coastline and protect valuable infrastructure. We have a lot of cultural heritage at the coast as well, marae, urupa, wahi tapu. We'll need to choose which areas get defended in that way, but we should do so with our eyes wide open in terms of the possible impacts of putting structures along the coastline. It's not always obvious what will happen.
Oh, that's very interesting. Have there been some unforeseen outcomes for more of those natural solutions? Of maybe slowing down the waves, sort of doing things to the seafloor?
Well, I mean, often those sort of engineering interventions are quite successful. Offshore breakwaters have been used in different parts of the world to slow down waves, which leads to sediments building up behind the breakwaters. But for sure, there are almost always impacts in the local ecological environment. Sometimes they can make the water more turbid. Sometimes also these structures fail. Most of them have a design life, and we have to think also about, well, what do we do at the end of that design life? For example, if you stop a cliff from eroding, sometimes the foreshore in front of the cliff continues to erode down, and when the structure eventually fails, like a seawall, when it's eventually removed, or if the decision's made not to fund it in the future, then the cliff erodes more quickly than it was before the structure was implemented as the coast tries to bounce back towards some sort of equilibrium state. So the answer is that most engineering interventions have some sort of adverse outcome, and we just need to, but they can also be very effective and protect homes and structures and infrastructure and so forth from erosion. So it's a careful case of weighing up the pros and cons in each individual example, I think.
Right, I take it that it's complicated, but it's too important to put into the too hard basket. Thank you so much, Mark. I've been absolutely fascinated by what you've told me today, and I really, really appreciate the time. So thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
Have a lovely afternoon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus, and do note Senior Focus is one word.
You're gonna meet some gentle people. Francisco. Gentle people with flowers in their hair. All across the nation, such a strange